we were going to move to look at the antitheses in Matthew 5, because this is where we have another piece of this Moses business, because what Jesus does is to draw these contrasts between the old law and the new law. And the old law is simply quoting, citing parts of the Mosaic law. And then the new law is the interpretation that Jesus gives of the old law. So, for example, 5:21. You have heard that it was said to the people of old, "You shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother or sister shall be liable to judgment." So, old law, don't kill. Or don't murder. New law, don't even think about it. That's right. Don't be angry. And of course, the difference here is between outward action and inward disposition. This inward disposition might lead to this outward action. So you have an intensification of the law, if you will. Namely, it's not merely a matter of outward acts. It's one's own heart, in the end, that gets judged in this understanding. So it's a radicalization and intensification of the law. Or the one after it in verse 27, you heard that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." But I say that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So old law, no adultery. New law, no lust. Again, because one can lead to the other. And so the notion is the conversion, not just of deed, but the conversion of heart, the transformation of heart. Now, as these antitheses continue, they change a little bit. For example, verse 38. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, don't resist one who is evil, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go two. Give to whoever begs, and do not refuse whoever would borrow from you. So, old law, eye for an eye. This is called the law of retaliation. The law of retaliation. What's the new law? You think it's the same?
Turn the other cheek?
Turn the other cheek?
I'm saying today.
Oh, today. No, I mean for Jesus.
It's nonviolent, right?
Yeah, turn the other cheek. This is an amazing thing, and there's a lot going on here. Part of it is certainly a nonviolent response, so that it's an ethic of non-retaliation. It breaks the cycle of violence, non-retaliation. But it's more than that, isn't it? It's more than that. It reminds me, actually, my son, who's now 17, when he was in grade school, I'll never forget this, he came home from school one day, and I asked, you know, the typical parent question, how was school? And he said, "I got into a fight." And I said, "You got into a fight? Well, what happened?" He's in fourth grade. He said, "Well, a kid pushed me, and so I used the golden rule, and I pushed him back." And I said, "Very interesting, Derek. How does that work exactly?" And he said, "Well, the golden..." I said, "Do you know what the golden rule is?" "Yeah. Do unto others what you want others to do unto you." I said, "And so you pushed him because..." "Well, since he pushed me, he must have wanted me to push him back." And that's when I knew he had all the makings of a biblical scholar. Right there. interpretation is the name of the game. But non-retaliation is certainly part of this. But what is it? Because when he was in school, they were teaching, you know, somebody pushes you or hits you or something, you walk away and you go to a, you know, a teacher or something. So this whole notion of walking away. I mean, Jesus could have said, you heard that it was said of old, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, don't retaliate. End of story. But he doesn't. He says, turn the other cheek. What in the world does that mean? Not a rhetorical question.
Another shot, dude?
What kind of compassion involved here towards the person that committed the first act?
Okay, so the person that committed the first act, the person that incites the violence, may well expect some kind of retaliation, and so is perhaps surprised by the non-retaliation. What else is suggested?
You're basically de-arming, aren't you? You're de-arming the other fellow. You're pulling him down, or you're just not reacting.
Okay, it's not escalating, but are you necessarily de-arming the other person, or disarming the other person?
Not abusing him,
maybe.
Inviting him to hit the other cheek, yeah. It's a very interesting move. The language that I've settled on, finally, is that the whole notion of turning the other cheek has to do with provoking righteousness. It's a provocative move to turn the other cheek. Because you're not going away, you're staying right there. And you risk something in the process. What you risk, of course, is getting smacked twice as hard on the other one. And as I like to tell my students at LMU, friends, it's no accident that at the end of the gospel, Jesus gets, oh, I don't know, crucified. There's a connection between this ethic and what happens to Jesus. Those who would provoke righteousness may find that there are people, frankly, who aren't interested in righteousness and would rather get you out of the way because you're troubling, because you're calling somebody to account for their actions. So it's a provocative action, and it invites another response from the person who has wronged you. So turning the other cheek basically says a couple of things. All right, I'm not going to respond in kind, and I'm now going to give you an opportunity to try this again. It's like another time my son, so funny, children are just great because they give you lots of illustrations. It's the main reason we have them. One time, and this is the videotape generation, at least, you know, now the CD generation, but when he was very young, something happened and he didn't like it and he asked if we could rewind. I wish we had that button in life, but, you know, we don't. But this does that. It basically rewinds and says, let's try this again. And you basically have one or two options. Either the person can smack you harder on the other cheek, and so the provocative part has worked, the righteousness part has not, or the other person can pause, realize it might be cooling down, and treat you differently. Maybe they'll respond not as an enemy, but as a neighbor. Because what provoking righteousness is all about is this notion of reconciliation. How does reconciliation come about? How does reconciliation take place? Well, somebody has to initiate reconciliation. And the process of initiating reconciliation involves no small degree of risk. Personal safety, personal risk. And I think this can be very, very frightening, and yet, this is the way that reconciliation comes about. Martin Luther King Jr., very much following in the tradition of Gandhi, went with this non-retaliatory approach, and provoked righteousness. And so when the police would come to arrest, part of the training was you don't deride the police as they're coming to arrest you. You don't call them names or anything. You treat them like a neighbor. Are you sure you really want to be doing this? Do you really think this is the just thing to do? And so what you're doing is you're trying to inspire a different response that will lead to the kind of change, to the kind of reconciliation that you're seeking. Now, it continues on. So, old law, eye for an eye, new law, turn the other cheek. It continues on. This is verse 43. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. So, love neighbor, hate enemy. Namely, take care of your own and be suspicious of anybody on the outside because they're a threat, they're a danger. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. This is simply the same kind of thing, isn't it? It's this notion of seeking reconciliation, of being provocative. What happens if your enemy harms you and you respond with love? Again, there are basically a couple of outcomes that are possible. One is your enemy can take advantage of your non-retaliatory response, and the enemy can take advantage of the openness that love requires. So your enemy can destroy you. That's what you're risking. You're risking destruction in the name of righteousness. Or your enemy can see that you are treating that person as a neighbor, and the enemy can respond as a neighbor. So that this transformation from enemy to neighbor, this kind of reconciliation, this kind of lived righteousness in community is the goal of all of this. But it's a rather risky business. And I think the difficulty we have as Christians today is with the risk that is involved in this process. Now, the other question that comes up here is, all right, this is this, you know, transformation from outward to inward. This is this care for the enemy as much as one cares for oneself and for one's own. What kind of an ethic is this? Is this simply an interpersonal ethic between people in the church? Is this simply an interpersonal ethic between you and people in the community? Is it a community ethic? Is this national policy? I mean, what kind of an ethic is this? And Christians have debated this for many, many years. Some people say that this is, we'll get more good language up here, a prudential ethic. All this means is that Jesus really means you to live this way. This is actually what Jesus means. So, for example, one ethicist wrote, if Christians really lived this way, this was when the gaze in the military was hitting things during the first Clinton administration, he said, if Christians really lived out this ethic, then the people you would be most suspicious of are Christians, not gays or lesbians, because you wouldn't know if that person was going to pull a trigger to save your life because they were loving that other person across the way. So would Christians really agree to fight? And so that's one approach. Another approach says this is a non-prudential ethic. Namely, it wasn't really meant to be practiced on a level beyond individuals. And even then, it was intended as an ideal. Namely, it works like this. The goal certainly is love. That's what we hope for. But in this world, often we have to settle for justice. And justice sometimes means using force. Justice sometimes means this other. So that this is the ideal, but this is where we end up. And so this is a non-prudential ethic. It's not, Jesus didn't really mean for you to live this way, but it kind of sets an ideal standard. And so that's pretty much what you have. So what do you think? Let's vote. The Christian community fights about this all the time, about what this means. And we fight about it, and as churches take positions on political issues, we fight about it in many, many ways. So the question is, what would it mean to live this out? Yes?
I don't think it's really been tried.
Okay.
I think it would be worth a try, especially in the political and national realm.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is that if a nation attacks us, we say, please don't do that. And they kind of look at us and say, huh, they're not dropping bombs on us, why don't we keep going?
Well, my response to that would be, number one, I wouldn't retaliate. I would not do to them what they just did to me. Number two, I would gather people together and say, we have a situation here in the world, in this small planet. How are we going to deal with this as a planet, you know, rather than making a decision one country towards another country?
Okay. How likely do you think it is? I'm not arguing for this. My job is to play devil's advocate. How likely do you think it is that while you're having that conversation at the UN, the aggressor country or whatever decides they're talking themselves to death, let's just move in?
It could happen.
Is that a risk that you take?
Well, I would say you face the fact that we are now in a risky position, folks. You know, we are not going to be safe, 100%.
That's why we have Homeland Security.
Gandhi and Martin Luther King. It is viable. It does work. We have those examples. So I think it's risky. It's terribly risky. Those people endure terrible, terrible things. But ultimately, they have made a huge difference.
Yeah.
They have, but the question does. Here's an example for you. There are two brothers, Reinhold Niebuhr and H. Richard Niebuhr, and these are two of the most significant 20th century ethicists. Reinhold Niebuhr was on the cover of Time magazine in the 1950s because Reinhold Niebuhr argued, yes, the goal is love, but justice is the most we can hope for this side of God's kingdom. What that means is that if the poor, or if somebody in an inferior situation, in a weaker situation, is being attacked, you must defend them. Jesus defended people against the Pharisees with words. By extension, we must defend those people who are being oppressed and attacked, at least with words, and sometimes with bullets. And so, should we participate in World War II? Absolutely, he said. His brother, H. Richard Niebuhr, also a world-renowned ethicist, said, my brother's wrong. Because what the Christian message calls attention to is the cross. And the cross is one of embracing human suffering and not responding in kind. I don't know if any of you remember the movie The Mission.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's another perfect example of this, because here you have the Robert De Niro figure who repents and leads the native peoples in violent rebellion against the Spanish invaders, while Jeremy Irons, playing this a Jesuit, walks towards the invaders who are about to kill them, simply holding the cross and walking faithfully. And so the question is, how does one negotiate that tension? And that's the ultimate tension in the experience. Please.
There's another beautiful film, I think it's called Bonhoeffer.
Yes.
About his life. And to me, that message was so beautiful because he was safe in this country during Hitler's time.
He was a colleague of the Niebuhrs, by the way. Yeah.
Okay, he could have saved himself, but instead he went back to Germany and was put in a concentration camp and was killed in unity with his people and to say no to what Hitler was doing.
Yes, but how did he say no to Hitler?
I forget.
He tried to assassinate him. He joined the plot to kill Hitler.
Okay.
And so he engaged in this, it's the lesser of two evils kind of approach. Yes. Yes.
Well, my feeling is, in our society, we have the drug situation. We have the drug situation where there are drug lords,
there are drug lords.
Those who are hell-bent to get their way in.
There are destructive people in the world.
Right. And, and our neighborhoods, and they go on Columbia, which is smaller. So how can you let them just be? You have to have some kind of police have to be there trying to do what they can to get off the street.
So how do you respond to this kind of crime? How do you respond to people who all they want to do is find people foolish enough to risk reconciliation? Say that again?
So Clayton
says to a drug person,
you know, I've been giving you drugs, and they'll laugh at you.
Oh, right. So the question is, how do you affect transformation? How do you get people who are engaged in violent behaviors to change their ways? Have any of you ever heard of Homeboy Industries?
Yeah.
Have you ever had Greg Boyle up here to talk?
No.
You need to get him to come up here to talk.
Well, he came up, but I went and couldn't get a parking place in East Hampton. It was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and every place I went...
He didn't save you with space?
He didn't save me with space, and neither did...
I'll talk to him.
It was all the cabin. Institute,
yes.
And they didn't make provision for parking for outsiders.
Alice, will you get on that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Greg Boyle is a very interesting character. He's a Jesuit. He is housed at Dolores Mission in Boyle Heights in East L.A., and he works with gang members. And he's convinced that if you love these people, if you go to prison and visit them, if you see them when they come out of prison, if you invite them in, if you invite members from rival gangs in, if you offer a service that does tattoo removal, if you help find them jobs, if you create jobs, he has the slogan of Homeboy Industries is, nothing stops a bullet like a job. That's the slogan. And his conviction is, these people, industry pulls out. And so we need to have businesses that are willing to risk giving these people jobs and livelihoods, and then perhaps reconciliation and transformation will come about. But his approach really is one person at a time. It really is his approach. Yes, your response.
I can mention that in the movie West Side Story, we had a gang from gangs Tony.
Tony, exactly.
One to break away from the gang, he didn't want to do it.
And he got killed.
He got sucked into trying to do the right thing, but then his emotions got the best of him and he ended up doing what he didn't want to do. He was killed.
Yes, he did. Which raises the point. He was doing it for love of Maria, right? He was doing it for love of Maria, but in this vision, you're doing it because you're seeking reconciliation with the enemy. He wasn't so much seeking reconciliation with the enemy as he wanted to be with Maria, and however that could come about.
But he did want to make a break.
He did want to make a break, that's true. The issue here ultimately comes down to this. What's the worst thing that can happen to you as a Christian if you risk provoking righteousness?
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Isn't it basically good against evil, and those who are really good wind up
dying for their goodness, as did Jesus, as did the early Christians, as does Martin Luther King, as does, so that it really doesn't work. In this world that we live in, it doesn't work.
Okay, she's wondering if it's a legitimate question. She's wondering if it's effective, right?
Well, I think, I think it's a very much deeper question, and it's much deeper than practical everyday life. I think the ultimate goodness, you have to actually die to find ultimate goodness. And to me, that's the way I would interpret that. In a world that we live in, I don't think that it's possible to live that way.
Okay, so then you would agree with Niebuhr that the most you can hope for is justice, and it's unfortunate that sometimes people will have to die in the process, but that's, you're always choosing lesser evil. That's what Niebuhr argued for. His brother argued you're always choosing for the greater good, and if you die in the process, basically what of it? His response was, it's all crucifixion. He agrees with you. It's all crucifixion, but what do we believe? We believe in a God who brings life from death. And so you have to act in the world in such a way where you are seeking to bring life from death, whether that's working one-on-one with gang members, whether that's, whatever that means. Now, one other theologian has put it interestingly. He says, Christians are called to be faithful, not successful. It's a very interesting approach. So the response would be, you're right. Gandhi got killed, Martin Luther King Jr. got killed, a lot of early Christians got killed, a lot of good people get killed because they're acting in righteous ways. And his response would be, yeah, that happens. And that the belief is that God ultimately prevails, even though it appears that things aren't going so well. But I should be quiet. Yes, 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 yes. Why don't we all speak at once?
Can you go back to the question that you were on? What's the worst thing that can happen if?
Oh, what's the worst thing that can happen to you? And I think the response is the worst thing that
if
can.
If you risk, continue that. If you risk. Righteousness?
If you risk provoking righteousness.
Yeah. What's the worst thing? Okay.
What's the worst thing that can happen? I mean, let's face it. What can happen to you is, let's say you're a whistleblower at work. You can get fired. I think that the most difficult thing, I think we are willing to let things happen to ourselves. I think the most difficult thing is that we do all kinds of things on behalf of those that we love. So, for example, we're supposed to give to all who ask for it. So I'm in Santa Monica, and there are a lot of people asking for things. So do I give away everything? What about my kids, Do I need to take care of them as well? What's my responsibility to them? And so that's on the one hand. On the other hand, if I don't love the children of my enemy as much as I love my own children, then am I living the gospel? That's a question I also ask myself. What does it really mean to love the enemy? Well, it means that I want as much for their child as I want for mine. And I'm not willing to sacrifice the future of their child so that my child can have a future. I'm not willing to put those two at loggerheads. I'm not willing to make that compromise. Ideally, I think that's what the way it should be. I don't think I do that very well. But that's what I personally struggle with. Yes, 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 yes.
You're speaking about context. And I think the lady that was speaking of it just earlier, she was talking about context. And here we are in Santa Barbara, 2006. We are living, and we're worried that if we do something, the worst thing that could happen to us is we get killed.
Well, bad things happen to good
bad
people.
Things happen. But I think we have to, if we're Christians and we truly believe that, number one, we are all going to die, and when we face God, are we going to say, well, God, Lord, I killed a whole bunch of people, but it was sort of in self-defense, and, they were going to kill me, so I killed them. And he's going to understand that, or he's going to say, well, how'd you die? And then you say, well, I got hit by the bus. And then, so I think we have to look at what we're going to end up with in heaven and how we have to explain it to somebody else, our actions here. versus Dean here in this context, we're always worried that somehow somebody's going to do something to us.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, if somebody broke into my home, I don't own a gun. I think guns are really nasty things. If somebody broke into my home, and I had and they threatened my children, and I had an opportunity to disable the person, I think I probably would.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, putting
a why is that right?
Jail is not exactly taking his life away from him. I mean, there's a certain amount of force that you can use, I think, and still be Christian.
Ah, here we go. How much force would that be exactly?
Well, we have jail. We put these people in jail. We don't have to kill them. I mean, but in the back of the Testament days, we would just stone them to death if they did anything.
Okay. So see, but now we get to play the game of how much violence is enough or how much violence is too much. When is invading a country defending our country? It's a slippery slope city. Let me get some other folks in here. I see your hand as well. Yes and yes.
Well, I think that we have to start with justice. And because with justice, if we were really just these people who don't have jobs and who get, you know, use drugs, etc., because they have to spare, we would create situations where we could have more things, like Boyle has done, where he created an industry for these people. If we also change some of our laws to make drugs legal, so that it's not a profit-making type of industry, it would take away the glamour of people getting in there so they can make as much money. I mean, I worked in the jail system, and a lot of these people who are using the drugs are doing it because they can't find a job that will pay them what they make just by selling, you know, one package of drugs. Mm-hmm. They can make more money that way. I think the justice system has to take precedence if we have a good system of justice where we do try to provide for people or we do try to give opportunities, then I think we can go on to love. But okay. I think we have to have justice before we get to the love.
Okay. Here, then over there, and here and there.
What about the concept of enabling? You know, loving and risking and all that, you're enabling this person to continue in whatever they're doing. I mean,
why is that enabling?
Anybody who's had a drug addict in their family or anything like that, you know how horrible that is.
Yeah, but there's also such a thing as tough love, right?
Well, you're being tough. You're punishing them or whatever. You're not. So I'm just saying that concept on a larger scale, if someone's pointing a gun at you or hits you or knocks your jaw, they're trying to grab your purse and you just turn to the chief, you're just enabling them to continue in the the evil that they're doing.
But the point is, you're not. This is not turning of the cheek is not a passive act. It's an active engagement of the other as a realized human being. And so, if somebody breaks in, I'd like to think the first thing I would do would be to say, "Hi, my name's Jeff. What's yours?" Apparently things aren't going so well for you that you're doing this. Let's talk. Have you read the genealogy of Matthew? I don't know. But I think somehow, if we don't treat other people as honest-to-God people, then what reason do they have to treat us as human beings? And so I think if we actually treat other people like people, yes, it's risky. It's very risky. But I think that's part of the Christian ethic. I think the difficulty again comes when it involves children, when it involves our ability to care for children and all the rest. But at least that's my own perspective. Hold on. We were going over here, and then here, and then there, and then somewhere over here.
I just thought it was very interesting that this morning I was listening to President Bush speak, and as you probably all know, in Palestine,
the Hamas.
Major happened, and that is that Hamas won. Well, last night it was 40%. I don't know what it ended up this morning.
It's more.
Yeah. So here you can take a situation similar to what Greg Boyle has done. Hamas has created a complete infrastructure for the Palestinians. They provide the hospitals, the schools, support, jobs. Okay? We have our government that claims to be, you know, the Christian government, refusing to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
I personally have a real issue with that because this is a democratically elected group.
Now, of course, this is where the justice thing comes in, because
the justice is open to interpretation.
It is. Here's the question, though, and this is, no big surprise, I'm not a big fan of Bush, but if you're looking at somebody who says, I don't think that person has a right to exist, I'm going to do all that's within my power. And so that's what the Bush administration is calling for before they're willing to recognize it.
Right.
But again, it's a question of strategy, perhaps. But it's a good point. It's a very good point.
No, I agree that is a big stumbling block to get over with. But you have to know that in that organization of Hamas, that is probably split.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing is...
So what does it mean to provoke righteousness with Hamas leaders? In the Presbyterian Church...
I mean, they can look at us in the same light.
Yeah. Well, in the...
Iraq. I mean, they could say the same thing.
You may not remember this, but a few months ago in the Presbyterian Church caused a big scandal because we had representatives go and meet with the Palestinian authorities and basically argue for the Presbyterian Church to divest all of its stock in Israeli-held companies in protest of how the Israelis were treating the Palestinians. This caused a huge furor, but again, they were seeking justice, as they saw it, for the Palestinians. But what would it, and I think what they were doing was also going and meeting and saying, look, you know, you need to recognize Israel. So how much you can do this on a national political level, how much of this stays on an individual interpersonal level, that's very much, I think, the debate.
The author of this book, Crosby, talks about that in his preface.
Yes, he does.
It all boils down to how much are you willing to change your way of life?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is the whole...
And what is, well, and what does it mean to change one's way of life to be more faithful to what God is calling you to do? And different Christians of different stripes, Bush included, Clinton included, Jimmy Carter included, all have rather different interpretations of what that is. And so the question is, why do you come down where you come down? Why do you make the decisions that you make, that this is what it means to be faithful? And I think that's the kind of conversation that we need to have here and then there and then over here.
Well, actually, maybe two more, if that's okay.
Can we do three?
Sure.
How about four? This is the whole Abraham bargaining with God. Here and then here.
Well, I'm just saying, because it sounds like you have to make a choice. Either you're for love or for justice.
No, I don't think it's a choice, but go ahead.
I think love should always try love first. But, you know, if someone has kind of gun to your head and tell me, you know, give me this or you know, I'm going to take a child or whatever, I mean, you have to defend yourself.
Ah.
And so if it means you have a knife and that's the only way you can, you know, stop.
Well, here's a question for you. You just said you should always try love first, right? Okay. Gun to your head. I'm going to treat you like a human being. I may die in the process of treating you like a human being. I may die in the process of showing my child that I'm going to treat this person like a human being. What are you showing your child about what it means to be a human being in the world? It's, You know, how quickly do you shift from love to justice? You know, how it's.
I see your point, but that's how it's instant. You know,
just.
All right, you win. Yes, and then one last one. Well, he defends the oppressed.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am free to turn my other cheek and to die for it.
Yes.
Is it appropriate, should I suggest, insist, or advocate that others, perhaps the oppressed, turn their cheek and die?
That's a very good question. Should you suggest that the oppressed turn? What I would say is that if you are in Christian community with the oppressed, that would be a very interesting conversation to have, because it's a conversation really about class, in our culture at least. What does it mean for those who are poor and downtrodden? What does it mean for them to turn the other cheek? I would suspect it means the same thing as it does for us. They may find themselves in situations where that comes up more frequently than we find ourselves, simply because we tend to be more insulated and isolated from those situations. But it's a very good question. I would say this is a call of every Christian, regardless of whether you're poor, rich, whatever. That's what I would say. Good question. And then, final word. Should we give her the final word? Oh, okay.
I think so much about what you said. I think there is a lot of complexity that we like to simplify often in like good and evil terms. Good and evil, and especially when we're on label people. And I think that David comes to mind when you talked about, Bathsheba being called the wife of Uriah. I mean, look at what God did with that situation. And in terms of transformation, and when you talked about the outward action versus the inward disposition, like, if you want to ask the question, who is our enemy, and do we believe that that enemy can be transformed and then their inward disposition can change? And do we believe God's action can be brought about through our actions? I mean, I'm just shocked. Osama bin Laden, you know, he's like equated with evil in our country. Do we believe that we could hold him in a different light? Or do we believe that God can?
Or do we believe that he could hold us in a different light?
Exactly.
Who sees us as an enemy and why?
Exactly. Right.
What does it mean to seek reconciliation with those who see us as enemies?
Right, and I think that we don't often want to look at the big picture. I'm glad you brought the elections today, because I was listening to a lot about that this morning, and I think that we don't want to go and figure it all out and study it, because it's very, very complex. Until we want to reduce it, to something, so we can be on the right side. I mean, I go back and say, we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How many people died? Yes, you can look at that in a bigger picture and take both sides of the issues, and Christians do.
They do.
But, it's too hard. We want to make it easy. We want to say, oh, no, I'm a traditionist and I'm righteous in my position, and no one else is.
Yeah. Well, friends, go and seek reconciliation. Bring your Bibles next week. And thank you very much.
Okay. This actually ended on a very serious note, but I think it's really what it's all about, in being here and trying to understand where Jesus is relying on this whole topic. Just to put it in a really large perspective for me anyhow, this month's National Geographic has a chart that charts, it's called the Century of Death, and it charts the amount of mass murders that there have been in the last century. I added up all the numbers from all the different countries. 90 million people killed in the name of ethnic cleansing or culture, political, religion. I mean, this is a serious question, and we're looking to the model of Jesus to try and find a way to stop really moving more towards being the first species to make it self-extinct. So these are important questions, and
I want to thank Jeff for coming and really setting the context for us and for catching me on my first class of your quick talk today.
No, the checks still aren't coming.
Anyhow, we're so happy to have the resource of the loyal, very not many fine professors there.
I understand you all had fun with Daniel Smith Christopher.
Oh, that was great. Yeah. So anyhow, thank you.
Thank you.